It is time for another episode of the All Things Nintendo podcast. I am Brian Shea from Game Informer, and this is a weekly podcast to discuss all the biggest news and games from the world of Nintendo. Unfortunately, not a whole lot of news in the world of Nintendo this week, but as you probably saw when you looked at the title of this episode, this is a very special episode as I am beyond thrilled to introduce this week's guest. You likely know him as the former president and COO of Nintendo of America, or you may just know him as a man who's about kicking ass and taking names. But he also has a fascinating book that just hit store shelves this week. That book is called Disrupting the Game, From the Bronx to the Top of Nintendo. Welcome to All Things Nintendo, Reggie Fils-Aimé. Reggie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastically well. How are you?
I'm doing so well. I've been reading your book. I've been absorbing all the lessons therein. I am excited to talk to you about the book, about your time at Nintendo, all kinds of great things. I'm excited for our listeners to get to know you. And there is a way that we do that here. It's a very important rite of passage on All Things Nintendo, and that is a segment called First Nintendo Game, Favorite Nintendo Game. It's not the catchiest. Maybe I could use your marketing expertise to get a better name for that. But it's a way that we get to know you through the lens of Nintendo. And the first question is, can you recall your first experience with a Nintendo game or a Nintendo console? And is that the time that kind of made you fall in love with the company?
So truly first Nintendo game experience was, probably dropping quarters for Donkey Kong, like so many during that time. But my first true console experience with Nintendo was the Super Nintendo Entertainment System and Super Mario World that came with my system. And I was enthralled by the game. I played it to full completion, completed it with 99 lives. And, I think in fairness, it wasn't the game that necessarily completely hooked me in. The answer to that will be your next question, right? The favorite of all time, but certainly an introduction to all things Nintendo through Super Mario World was pretty special.
Well, that's interesting because while my first Nintendo game was actually Legend of Zelda or Super Mario Brothers, maybe even Tetris, Super Mario World and the SNES, that was the bundle that was the first video game console I ever owned. It really got me hooked on the lifestyle of a gamer. So I'm right there with you, Reggie, and I'm definitely happy that you had that same experience. And you're right, there is a second part to this question, and that is, what is your favorite Nintendo game of all time?
And so again, I'm going to cheat a little bit and give two answers. So up until 5 years ago, my favorite game of all time was Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past. And this truly was the first Nintendo game that completely sucked me in, that I played for hours and hours and hours, solving the puzzles, battling as Link. I was at a point in the game where I actually called the Nintendo hotline and tried to get a hint for solving one of the dungeons. this game completely consumed me. I was working at Pizza Hut at the time as a marketing director for geographically about a third of the country. And I would play Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past until the wee hours of the morning and then go off to work. It truly became a second job for me. But as I said, 5 years ago, it changed. And now my favorite Nintendo game of all time is Legend of Zelda: Breath of the Wild. And I actually have to look at my Switch and see how many hours I've put into that game. But I love that game. I'll put it down and then come back to it, 3 months later, dust off the rust of my skills, get back out there. It's a pretty fantastic experience for me.
For me, Breath of the Wild actually replaced Ocarina of Time as my favorite Nintendo game and my favorite game of all time, period. But you're right, like Breath of the Wild just kind of flipped the Zelda formula on its head, and it gave you such an immersive and vast experience. And I would have to look at my Switch to tell you how many hours I've put into it. It's definitely north of 100, 150. And it's, just spent every waking moment when that game came out exploring every nook and cranny of Hyrule. And it was such a special experience. And I'm really glad that you had a similar experience as I did. And it must have been interesting working at Nintendo when that game was coming out, when the Switch was coming out. And we are going to get into kind of like your career at Nintendo. But for those who don't know, like prior to joining Nintendo, you actually worked at companies like VH1, Procter & Gamble. You mentioned Pizza Hut. How did working for those companies differ from working at Nintendo?
You know, in many ways, I see my professional journey as setting me up for the success that I had at Nintendo. And by that, I mean at Procter & Gamble. I joined that company at a very young age, 22 years old or so. I was working alongside people who were 5 up to 10 years older than I was, doing exactly the same work. All of those others had MBAs or other professional experiences. I joined Procter & Gamble right out of Cornell University undergrad. And so it was a fantastic training ground. And that organization gave me the foundation of all of my business experience. You know, from there, I went into the restaurant industry, which is incredibly fast-paced. I mean, you know your business results from yesterday as you look at your receipts and you look at your transaction data. And that pace absolutely set me up for the pace of the video game industry, where things are changing constantly. You know, the pace of innovation is so quick that having experience in fast-moving industries, you know, was critically important. My time at Guinness, you know, framed for me how working on a game that has such a passionate, loyal base of consumers, just as Nintendo, just as really all of the key brands and franchises in the video game space, you know, have their passionate fans. That was a key learning experience for me. And then spending time in the entertainment industry with VH1 also set me up for success. So, you know, my journey was not typical. My journey had a number of, dare I say, left turns as I pursued different opportunities, but I can absolutely see how each one set me up to be an effective executive and leader at Nintendo.
Yeah, and you really get the sense for that when you read through your book. I've actually read through the majority of it. I didn't quite finish it, which was my goal before we had this conversation, but it's a really fascinating read. I'm having a great time reading through it. I'm getting towards the end now, and it's just like, oh man, I remember when this was happening. It's so fascinating to see it from your perspective. And I actually do want to start our conversation about your time at Nintendo with something in my introduction to this episode there. E3 2004 was when you kind of burst onto the public scene for many of the gamers that are listening to the show. And you started the Nintendo presentation at E3 that year with the line, "I'm about kicking ass, I'm about taking names, and we're about making games." And you talk about that in your book. And I really love that story because the line was originally, "I'm about making games," but you petitioned to change it. Why was that single word change so important to you?
Well, if you think back to that time, Nintendo as a company and as a leader in the video game space was having a tough time. So, 2003, at this point, the GameCube and the original Microsoft Xbox are out in the market, but are being dwarfed by the PS2. Mm. Also, Sony, the prior E3, had simply announced that they were planning to enter the handheld business, you know, to go after that last part of Nintendo's business that was dominating from a share performance with Game Boy and Game Boy Advance. Simply with Sony's announcement, Nintendo's stock took about a 10% haircut. So the company was being challenged, but the company recognized that with the products and the plans that were in place, and this included the launch of the Nintendo DS, this included showing the very first trailer for Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. We were getting some very good third-party support on GameCube. This is when we highlighted Resident Evil 4 coming to the GameCube. Mm-hmm. We also had The second Metroid Prime game coming out on that platform. So we had some great products and some great initiatives to drive the business forward, but we needed to flip the switch. We needed to highlight all of these different initiatives and to do it in a new way. And it fell on my shoulders to do that. You know, I spoke to probably 85% of that press conference with Mr. Awada doing a piece, and George Harrison, our head of sales and head of marketing at the time, leading that effort. And so that was our situation. We needed to come out with a level of aggressiveness. But the last part of the opening stanza, you know, I am about making games, just wasn't true. And, you know, as we rehearsed the line, it became more and more clear that if our goal was to change our agenda, to go in this different path, all of our constituents needed to believe what we were trying to do. And for me to say, I'm about making games, just wasn't believable. I don't write code. You know, I don't create a script for a video game. It's just not what we do. But because of all of the broad support we had from our business partners, we're about making games really was the more appropriate statement. And as we made that change in the language, it really all came together, that what we were trying to do was taking Nintendo down a different path, looking to expand the gaming universe as we framed it, and to get more people playing games and doing it with our franchises, with our devices. We're about making games really was the right button for how we would open that press conference.
And I have to say, like, I apologize for laughing at a situation that was probably very stressful for you at the time, but you described Mr. Minagawa's question about your kicking ass line and asking you why you're so angry. That actually made me laugh out loud when I read it, because it's just a classic lost in translation moment there, I think.
It was, in many ways, it was good that he asked that question, because, you know, it released all of the tension in the room. And it really highlighted that as we were sharing this approach, you know, this what you're describing, the event you're describing, is when we first sat down with Mr. Awada, with Mr. Minagawa as his translator, sharing the line and sharing the approach we wanted to take for E3 2004. And so, you know, Mr. Minagawa, you know, not fully understanding what it was that we were trying to do, asking Reggie, why are you so angry, was the perfect opportunity for us to just take a step back, to explain our strategy, to go into detail in our approach. And, you know, in the end, during that meeting, Mr. Awada said, yes, I support this. I want to move forward. And we scripted the balance of the overall E3 approach. But it was a critical time and a critical moment. And you know, taking the tension out of the room was exactly what needed to happen for us to push it forward.
For sure. And that 2004 E3 press conference or presentation is so legendary now. You had your introduction to the Nintendo fans. You had the famous scene with Shigeru Miyamoto coming out with the Master Sword and the Hylian Shield to reveal Twilight Princess. You had the DS reveal. And then you had a thing in your book about how, like, I believe it was your daughter had texted you saying, like, you're famous. What was that like? That was kind of like the beginning of the Reginator, if I'm not mistaken.
So during those times, Nintendo would do two events same day. In the morning, we would do the press conference for media. That would be taped in part and then broadcast by a variety of different gaming outlets. And then in the afternoon, we would do a business meeting, a business presentation for retailers, for all of the third-party publishers. And we had a gap between these two meetings. I was trying to quickly get some lunch, and I received a phone call from my son. I have three children. This is my middle son, who calls me and says, "Dad, you're famous." And I'm, you know, I'm all I'm focused on is having completed one presentation, focusing on the next. And I said, "You know, what do you mean?" And he said, "Dad, you are all over the gaming internet." And, you know, he is a very active gamer, and he would surf all of the various gaming websites, the big ones that we worked with at the time, but also, you know, some of the smaller, more trendy type of gaming outlets. And he said, "Dad, you're all over them. You know, they're photoshopped images of you blowing up a PS2 and an Xbox with laser beams coming out of your eyes. They've made you up with backgrounds of Resident Evil. You're all over the place." And I said, "You know, so, you know, I have a job for you. I want you to collect all of these visuals. I want you to send me hyperlinks to these. Do this over the next hour, and you know, you'll make your dad happy." And he proceeded to do that, and I gave all of this information to Perrin Kaplan, our head of comms at the time, and said, "Perrin, you need to review all of this. We need to understand what's going on. You know, why are the fans reacting this way?" And it literally became a new and ongoing part of all of our activities for any major event we would do moving forward. This type of fast response, gather the information, see what the fans are reacting to, good or bad. But it was all started by my son, who called me up and said, "Dad, you're famous."
I apologize for getting that detail wrong there, but I love that story of just kind of like the birth of you as like this internet darling. And has the internet ever kind of caught you off guard with their reactions and like their memifications of you?
I wouldn't say that it's caught me off guard. I have to say I've always been surprised, a bit amused by the reaction that I have in the internet, all of the memes. I because I began in this industry as a player, you know, playing all of those, you know, very, very original video game systems, all of my early experiences with Nintendo systems, Sony systems, Microsoft systems, you know, I entered this as a player. So I believe I still have a player's sensibility and a player's love for franchises. And so I always found it just as a surprise how the fans reacted and reacted in such a positive way. And now in retirement, I'm able to have fun with it. You know, I troll fans back on Mother 3 and that whole experience. And I'm fortunate to have that type of relationship even today with the broad gaming community.
And something that kind of brings up is in your book, you describe a very memorable first interaction with the legendary developer Shigeru Miyamoto. And I've only met him once, but I remember being kind of like utterly beside myself to be meeting the man who was behind Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong, all these franchises that I grew up playing. And you yourself being a fan before you actually entered the industry, were you as excited or nervous to meet him for the first time as I was?
Well, as I describe in the book, I was a bit shocked, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for the listeners here, I made a trip to Japan to Nintendo's headquarters in Kyoto within the first 6 weeks that I was on board as an executive. And that trip was to see all of the early content that we would be leveraging at E3 2004. So this is January of 2004. And I am in a conference room. And to put this also in perspective, Nintendo takes its security extremely seriously. So we are in a locked conference room with an exposed prototype of the Nintendo DS. So this is two screens on a motherboard with chipsets and soldering that is running. We were shared two early prototypes. One of the early prototypes that was being shared with us was what would become Nintendogs. Mm-hmm. And so we're here with the technical and software developers for the system. And so imagine the exposed motherboard of DS is, let's say, at the front of this circle. We're gathered around it in a circle, and we're all making comments and asking questions about this brand new system. And even though I'd only been with the company about 6 weeks, I'm expected to make comments, I'm expected to provide my point of view. And we happen to be talking about all of the various input ways for the consumer to interact with the system. We talked about the voice controls, and we were talking about the touchscreen capabilities of the Nintendo DS. And again, for the listener, at this point in handheld technology, touchscreens were not at all in vogue, not at all being used. Only high-end personal digital assistants really were using touchscreens at the time. There was no iPhone. And so I made the comment that, you know, we needed to really leverage the touchscreen, the uniqueness of the touchscreen. We were talking about Nintendogs and how that made great use of the touchscreen. And as I'm making these comments, I see out of the corner of my eye that someone has knocked on the door to this closed conference room. Someone is going to see who it is. They let a newcomer into the room. And all of this is happening out of the corner of my eye. I really can't see who it is. And then the other piece of perspective is that, you know, business is done in Kyoto, where there is sequential translation, which means someone speaks in Japanese, it's then translated into English, English speakers respond in English, it's then translated back into Japanese. So as we're talking about the touchscreen, this new person is entering the room, I'm making these comments about how important it's going to be, and everyone turns and looks to the newcomer. The newcomer into the room is Shigeru Miyamoto, who then starts saying how, you know, these comments are absolutely right. We need to highlight the innovation of the touchscreen. We need to highlight all of the experiences that we're going to show at E3 that take advantage of the touchscreen, as well as some of the other elements. And he finishes this statement by saying, "And who are you?" Right, pointing at me, because we'd never met before. And obviously, as he's making his comments and I turn to him, I recognize that it's Mr. Miyamoto. My knees begin to shake a little bit. So that was my first interaction with Shigeru Miyamoto. And it was pretty nerve-wracking, I must say.
I can't even imagine being like, who's this guy that's coming? Oh, it's one of the most legendary figures in entertainment, period. Just walking into the room.
Exactly. And then, you know, pointing and asking, you know, and so who are you? Right. So it was pretty, it's indelibly marked in my brain.
And, you know, he's certainly the most well-known among Nintendo developers, but when you look at like the stable of talent and experience under the company's umbrella, it's absolutely mind-blowing. You have Takashi Tezuka, you have Eiji Aonuma, Yoshiaki Koizumi, and like then even developers who aren't officially with Nintendo, but they create exclusive content for Nintendo, like the team behind the Pokemon series. You have Masahiro Sakurai. Just, it must give the company such a leg up to have just incredible visionaries with so much experience. And you see, I think you see that come through in the work that they produce.
Absolutely. You know, and for me as an executive, you know, meeting each of these individuals, spending time with each of these individuals. And again, I had the benefit of having played so many of these games, knowing the content. You know, I can remember on that same first trip in 2004, I met Mr. Aonuma. And again, I had known him from all of, you know, the Legend of Zelda games that he had his hand in, and being able to talk about the franchise, to talk about, you know, the various games and how they moved the franchise forward. You know, these were wonderful conversations that I was able to have with the developers. And I have to say, of all of the things that I miss from my Nintendo days, you know, being able to have a casual conversation with Mr. Aonuma, Mr. Tezuka, all of these wonderful people who are such passionate creators.
And I think that something that really stuck out to me, because as I mentioned, I've read the majority of your book, but you start disrupting the game with a bit of an emotional gut punch as you talk about your final meetings and visits with Mr. Satoru Iwata. And as someone who's tried to frame the importance of Mr. Iwata over the course of this podcast, I have no doubt that you can do a better job of that than I can. So when you think about his legacy, is it even possible to properly frame what he meant to Nintendo?
You know, I think you actually have to step further back and think about what he meant to the industry. There is no one who has been involved in, you know, some of the top selling systems, the top selling games and franchises, the way he has. You know, everything from, you know, his involvement in, you know, early NES and SNES content, Game Boy. He made an indelible mark on Game Boy content. His involvement, even on the periphery of key franchises like Pokemon, his being there at the inception of franchises like Kirby and Smash Brothers, obviously his personal mark on the Nintendo DS, the Nintendo 3DS, the Wii, even the Switch carries his hallmark. So, you know, he touched Nintendo certainly in an incredible way, but what he did for the industry and helping move the industry forward is something that has to be acknowledged. And for me personally, you know, despite my passion for Nintendo content, despite my passion for the industry, if Mr. Iwata had not been in his role, and if he and I had not developed the relationship we had, I don't know that I would have been with Nintendo for, you know, 16 years. I don't know that I would have left the mark that I did. His willingness to accept this brash American who pushed forward with a variety of different ideas, a variety of ideas that at that time for that company had never been done before, and his openness to consider my ideas, to then support my ideas, and to help push them forward, that's legendary. And for me, it would have been completely different without him and his role and the relationship that he and I had.
And I think that that comes through in your writing of him when you're reading through all these stories you have of your interactions with him. One, it's immediately apparent that you had just such a great affection for him and a great relationship with him. And also, he always, you know, he would push back on many of your ideas, but when you stood your ground and kind of defended your ideas, he always seemed very willing to listen to what you had to say and what your opinions were. And he often seemed to trust your judgment.
Very much so. You know, I would say it was this unique combination of his being willing to listen to my disruptive ideas, his willingness to discuss, I don't go into a tremendous amount of detail, but invariably with each of these ideas, you know, he and I would get into deep discussions, you know, where he's acknowledging, you know, the points that I'm making, I'm acknowledging the points that he's making. And invariably, the ideas would get better, and we'd continue to push them forward. But certainly, when it came to things where I had a deeper knowledge base than he did, yes, you know, he would trust my judgment. I share in the book the story of the Wii advertising, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, all of the listeners are going to go and look on various websites to see the advertising, but this was two Japanese executives traveling the Americas, highlighting the innovation of the Wii remote and playing Wii-based games with families as they interacted across the Americas. And the commercials would start with that legendary line, "We would like to play." And, you know, this advertising drove business results for the Americas as we ran it. And we focused on that advertising for roughly the first 3 years that we were launching the Wii, before we started to focus more on specific games and specific executions. But initially, you know, Mr. Iwata had concerns about that that advertising, and other executives in Kyoto had concerns. And their biggest issue was that these two Japanese businessmen were being too familiar. They were having too much fun with the families that they came across and the families that they were playing video games with. And, you know, I had to break down, you know, our thinking as to why that was such an intrinsic part of the advertising, because we were trying to get as many people to pick up a controller as possible. We were demonstrating games as diverse as, you know, Wii Sports to, you know, Zelda-based games, and that we needed to highlight the breadth and range of all of our content, that the breadth and range of the player, and how, you know, the Wii Remote and these two Japanese businessmen were partaking in the fun and creating the fun. And initially, the thinking was that he wanted me to completely revamp the advertising, which, based on the timeline that we were going to run the work, just was not practical. Mm-hmm. And so I pushed back hard. I was convinced that this advertising was world class, that this advertising would drive the business, and in the end, he agreed. And you know, I don't have this in the book, but later on, this is probably now 3 or 4 years after that discussion and after that decision. And at this point, it is clear that the Americas, so Canada, US, Latin America, are having by far the best business performance of any region in the world behind the Wii. And we're in a business meeting, and he literally turns to the group. This was not scripted. I didn't know he was going to do this. But he turns to the group and says, you know, congratulations, you know, the NOA team is having this wonderful performance driving the Wii. And I must say that, you know, it is largely due to Reggie and your efforts and the novel and disruptive ideas you've pushed forward. And he used the Wii advertising as the example, where initially he was not supportive Nintendo in Kyoto wasn't supportive, but we pushed, we persevered, we put it into the marketplace, and it drove a fundamental difference in performance versus the other territories. You know, that's just not done by a Japanese executive. That type of acknowledgement of fundamentally, you know, I was wrong, that you all were right, that you pushed this in a positive way. So it was that type of relationship that we had. And, you know, on a variety of different decisions. And, you know, I also highlight, you know, a key decision where I didn't convince him and what the ramifications of that decision was. And it was the pricing decision for the Nintendo 3DS. Mm. But net, you know, the relationship that he and I had was foundational to my tenure at Nintendo and my success there as an executive leading Nintendo of America.
And I think that, like, you know, the Wii obviously was just a runaway success. Some of the highest highs Nintendo's ever experienced came during the Wii era. And I think that when you described how the PlayStation 2 was so dominant over the original Xbox and the GameCube, while part of that was about, like, the third-party support, a large reason that, you know, a lot of people have pointed out, including yourself in this book, was that the DVD capabilities made it a piece of hardware that kind of penetrated the non-gamer market, got it into homes that otherwise wouldn't have had a gaming console. And when I read that, I immediately drew a parallel to what the Wii did. Like, my grandparents had Wiis. They never had an NES or an SNES or an N64. They had a Wii because Wii Sports was such a huge success, and having that be a pack-in game was just a perfect system seller. And it was such a great idea all around.
Well, absolutely. And yet again, the decision to pack in Wii Sports was controversial. And in fact, in the Japanese home market, they did not pack in Wii Sports. I was able to push the idea forward, and we executed it not only in the Americas, but the European markets also followed that strategy. And once again, you could look at the difference in performance. Combined, the Americas and Europe had a faster pace of adoption, sold more software per Wii console when you look at the pure mathematics and the pure economics. And so the decision to pack in Wii Sports, which was hugely controversial at the time, yes, ended up being a critical business decision that enabled the Wii to sell north of 100 million units and spawn some of the best-selling video games of all time.
And your book, going back to your book, it was just absolutely chock full of so many amazing stories from your time, both before and during your tenure at Nintendo. But really, at its core, it's a book about how to be an effective leader. And you have these the so what pullouts that take these anecdotes from the main text and distill them down into these teachable, digestible moments. Can you talk me through how you went through your career in retrospect and kind of choosing stories from your career to highlight in these sections?
Sure. So as I thought about this book, I read just a wide variety of other books in the same genre. You know, it's called a business memoir in the world of publications and literature. And I read a number of other business memoirs. And each of them, to me, felt like two different books loosely stitched together. Meaning, typically in other business memoirs, the first half of the book is the individual's journey through life and, you know, some key stories that the author believes are meaningful for the reader. And then the second half of the book would be a handful of key lessons or key principles to share. And I did not want to follow that formula in my book. I wanted to tell stories that frame for the reader where I came from, choices that I made, principles I learned. And I wanted to share these lessons and principles right after a critical story is being told that highlights how those principles were used. And that gave birth to this idea of the so what. And so every single story in the book has the so what, or the reason for the story, the key lesson to be learned, distilled down, you know, in a paragraph or a few sentences, so that as the reader, there is something tangible that I hope you take away from the book, and something that you apply to your own journey, whether you're an executive, whether you're a student, whether you're trying to figure out, you know, what's next for you and whatever phase of life that you're in. Highlighting these so what's was, you know, a bit of my own disruptive approach in this world of business memoirs to share what I was thinking and how to apply some key lessons. So, you know, I've been humbled by the reaction to the structure. I've been humbled by the reaction of these lessons. Everyone that I've given the book to and has reviewed the book have really picked up on this structure and how these key lessons are shared in a very very differentiated way, in a very positive way.
And they are really interesting to read through. And I think there are a lot of really great lessons to glean from the stories that you share. And this kind of relating to this, you and I don't expect you to remember this, by the way, you and I actually very briefly met at the Wii U launch at the Nintendo World Store in Manhattan in 2012. And you were extremely approachable, which, by the way, I very much appreciated. And one thing that stuck out to me that night was that you gave every employee of the Nintendo World Store their own Wii U. And then you had to come back on the following Monday to buy yours. And I overheard you telling the employees, the fact that you get the console for free while I have to come back and buy mine tells you who is really important in this organization. And that kind of stuck out to me and stuck with me as I continued watching and covering your career in the subsequent decade. If you had to distill that moment, and sorry, this is putting you on the spot. If you had to distill that moment down into a so what would be the key takeaway from that scenario?
You know, the so what in that case is, you know, your employees, you know, at the time, you know, I'm running a multi-billion dollar business with hundreds of employees. Every leader needs to recognize that the employee comes first in driving the performance and making an impact. So taking care of your employees is just so critically important. You know, I would frame this concept for people by saying, myself as a leader, there's only a certain amount that I can do. But if I positively impact 10 people, well, they can do 10 times as much. What about 50 people, 100 people, 1,000 people? If I'm able to empower, encourage, enable a greater and greater part of my organization, by definition, we will do so much more. And so my orientation was always on helping and supporting that, you know, that key part of the organization. And it really comes back to what I'm doing today. The reason I wrote the book, the reason I give speeches, the reason I go back on college campuses is to empower and enrich that next generation of leaders and to help them be successful. And if I'm able to do that, even just a little bit, I will have positively impacted just so much more, so many more people, so many more businesses than I can do by myself or that I was able to do in my role at Nintendo.
And one of the big points in disrupting the game is something that I think is counterintuitive to many of us. This is the so what that really stuck out to me. It's the notion of embracing our failures. What lessons did you take from like the Wii U period, and how did you handle that as a leader within the company?
You know, so again, putting this in perspective, as I said earlier, the Wii having sold over 100 million units, we saw the Wii U and the innovation of the gamepad as a key enabler to unique experiences. You know, we obviously saw that this was going to be a driver of performance and hoped to create something that would at least come close to the type of performance, if not exceed, what we had been able to do with the Wii. And it became clear after about 3 months that we had an issue. And it forced us to look hard at both, you know, what was working for the Wii U, because there were some things working. You know, in the United States, we sold almost a million units between Thanksgiving and Christmas when we first launched the Wii U, which is a very healthy number. Consumer satisfaction was high. So there were some things working. We needed to really understand what those were. And one of the biggest elements was this concept that, yes, I could play on a big screen TV, but when someone else wanted to use that TV, I could move the game from the TV to the gamepad and continue playing on my gamepad as long as I stayed within 30 feet of the console. Right? If you got too far away, the connection would be lost. So that was a critical insight that we needed to digest and to put into our next system. And we also needed to understand the areas that weren't working. We made it complicated for the consumer to understand the benefit of the Wii U. We had, you know, two different SKUs that we launched. One was black, one was white. There was differences in storage between the two, which led to some confusion. We did not keep a pipeline of game launches to sustain the launch. There were all of these things that we needed to really understand and embrace as key points of friction that kept us from being successful in the launch. And we had to take all of that and quickly apply it to the next system. I think if you look at the legacy of all of the Nintendo systems, you know, the worst selling system is the Virtual Boy. Mm-hmm. I do believe number two in terms of the second worst selling system is the Wii U, which was just a crushing, crushing situation. But the insights about the gamepad, the insights about wanting to play, you know, in a big screen type of experience, and then on a smaller screen experience, was something we took away. Having a strong pipeline of launches was something we took away. Streamlining the proposition, being clear in what we were offering, all of that you can see in the development and the execution of the Nintendo Switch. And so being able to pivot from, you know, the second worst selling system in the company's history to now, you know, what is currently, I believe, the second best selling system, only behind the Nintendo DS currently, you know, that was a huge pivot. But it was all based on what we were able to see and understand from the failures of the Wii U.
And you mentioned the Switch there, and that has proven just to be an overwhelming, astounding success and really flipped the script after the narrative that was painted during the Wii U years. And you mentioned it's even outsold the Wii now. What kind of peace did that give you in being able to ultimately retire from the company?
You know, when I first saw the Switch, held a prototype in my hands, you know, Mr. Iwata was still alive. We were having deep conversations on how we needed to launch this system. And, I believe he knew how long-term successful the system would be. Certainly, I knew as we launched the system and we saw the early success. And all of that helped me think through my my career at Nintendo and how and when I needed to exit from the company. You know, the other highlight I would give those listening to this podcast is when I joined Nintendo back in 2003, the North American organization had gone through a series of high-level transitions. Mr. Arakawa, who had been the longtime president for Nintendo of America, had retired. Tatsumi Kimishima had come on board as president. The heads of finance and sales and marketing, business affairs, all of these senior level positions had transitioned fairly recently to 2003. That coupled with the launch of the GameCube, which did not light the world on fire, that had created a really difficult situation for the company. So I was really focused that when it would be time for me to retire, that I not only needed the business to be on solid footing, and it was with the launch of the Switch, but I needed the organization to be on solid footing. We needed to have strong people in place, so that, you know, minimally for a few years after I retired, you know, the business would be in a strong place. And certainly that's come to bear. You know, the organization at Nintendo of America was able to navigate the challenges with COVID. They were able to navigate supply chain challenges, you know, to enable the company to continue driving success. So all of that helped me think through the timing for my retirement, and also making sure that I would focus on, you know, what was next for me, and it was doing things that would enable me to help that next generation of leader, and the book being a key part of that process.
And was the book kind of like, was the idea of having like kind of a meditation on your leadership style your first idea?
It actually wasn't. You know, my first idea for a book was entitled, or the concept, I should say, because we never got to the point of a title, but the concept was all the real world skills you can learn by playing video games. And the idea was, you know, how, you know, through a game like Dota, you know, you learn, you know, communication skills because you have to talk with your teammates and navigate, you know, to win that type of game. How you develop strategic thinking by playing Legend of Zelda: Breath of the Wild. And it's this thought of, you know, am I aggressive in taking on an enemy camp, or do I go around it and not risk breaking weapons and negatively affecting my inventory? You know, all of the choices you make in a wide open game like that in order to progress. And it's interesting, you know, maybe today if I were writing that book, I might use Elden Ring for that example in terms of having to make key strategic choices as you navigate through that game. Do I take on that superpowered enemy, or do I try and skirt around and not do that head-on confrontation? Mm. But that was my first idea for a book. And book agents and potential publishers all told me, you know, Reggie, this is a nice idea for a speech, but it really isn't. It isn't a book that's going to sell in quantity. So that's what then had me pivot to do more of this business memoir, but to do it again in a different way, in a way that reflects just how I think and how I want to help others on their own journey.
And, you know, it is still kind of definitely, I mean, it's definitely painted through that lens of your time at Nintendo largely. And then, of course, there's lessons from your time at VH1, at Panda, at Pizza Hut, all these different companies that you've worked at and done such really amazing work. And we've covered so much here today, Reggie, and your book has so many more fascinating anecdotes and lessons that you impart regarding leadership. If anybody listening to this show wants to read more stories from the life and career of Reggie Fils-Aimé, you can do so in his new book, Disrupting the Game, From the Bronx to the Top of Nintendo. It's available now wherever books are sold. And Reggie, you actually recorded the audiobook yourself. Was that your idea, or did the publisher ask that of you?
You know, it's interesting. I actually needed to convince the publisher. You know, when I announced the book, I had so many messages of, you know, I'm interested, but I want an audiobook. Reggie, are you going to read the audiobook? And at that point, we hadn't made a decision, and I had to share all of this information with the publisher. I actually had to do a 3-minute test read so that they would actually be convinced that I could do the audiobook, because in fairness, it's a lot of work. I mean, you're in a little studio, you're reading the book course of a couple days. It's hard work. And I think they needed to be convinced that not only that I could do it, but that I could do it effectively, that my voice would hold up. And it did. And the other wonderful thing with the audiobook is then I convinced my good friend Jeff Keighley to work with me on some bonus content for the audiobook. So if Disrupting the Game is my journey coupled with some key principles, the bonus content for the audiobook with Jeff, it's stories. It's storytelling from our mutual experiences in the video game space, all the fun he and I had in front of the camera, some of the things that we did behind the camera. And so that's a nice added bonus for folks who are picking up the audiobook.
Reggie, it was an absolute blast having you on. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of All Things Nintendo. And if people want to follow along with your adventures, you actually joined Twitter shortly after your retirement, which, by the way, how the heck did you land Reggie at Reggie on Twitter in 2019?
It's another great story. Someone actually had that handle, but they hadn't been using it. I had contacted the leadership there at Twitter and had asked what could be done, and fortunately we were able to get the handle, and I was able to use it on my final day at Nintendo as I joined the Twitter community. So yes, follow me at Reggie on Twitter. Not only do you get my various perspectives on gaming and the entertainment industry, but also just updates on leadership and other things that I'm seeing in the world and my reactions.
Reggie, thank you again so much for being so gracious with your time. It was great chatting with you. I know the listeners of this podcast are going to love disrupting the game as much as I have. And best of luck with launching this book.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciated the conversation. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to the reaction. I'm very, very excited.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you so much to everyone for listening to this very special episode of All Things Nintendo. If you like what you heard, give All Things Nintendo a 5-star review and hit that subscribe button. And if you want to get any questions or comments in, you can get in touch with me at allthingsnintendo@gameinformer.com or hit me up on Twitter or Instagram at Brian Pichet. And as always, you can join the Game Informer Community Discord, which is a perk for subscribing to our Twitch channel. That's our show for this week. Thank you all again so much for listening. Definitive Ranking and eShop Gem of the Week will be back next episode. Take care. We will see you next week.